come to seek beyond sight, to listen beyond sounds, to be opened to life at levels sometimes comforting and sometimes disturbing, but always in that neighborhood where our minds, hearts, and souls find their common ground and their common purpose. It is good to be together again, for it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. A place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. I want to share with you a short prayer. It is a Yoruba prayer from Africa. Prayers often sound funny to modern people, kind of foreign, as though they're talking to an imaginary friend up in the sky. This prayer can also be heard that way, but I invite you to listen to it differently, to let it get inside of you by asking to whom or to what for you could this prayer be addressed. It's very short. I'll read it twice. O Divine One, I give thanks to you, the one who is as near as my heartbeat and more anticipated than my next breath. Let your wisdom become one with this vessel as I lift my voice in thanks for your love. O Divine One, I give thanks to you, the one who is as near as my heartbeat and more anticipated than my next breath. Let your wisdom become one with this vessel as I lift my voice in thanks for your love. Amen. I've been thinking for a while that we need a fresh way of looking at the importance of our lives. We need better stories. We need more interesting plots to live out. I don't say this only because recently I spent 4 days in Lubbock. Though it is related. I gave 4 talks there last weekend. One on a theological argument for abortion given to an audience of Texas Tech students, where I got over an hour's questions, all of them hostile. Lubbock, as some of you may know, doesn't permit sex education in its public schools. It also has the highest teen pregnancy rate in Texas. It gets better. Texas has the highest teen pregnancy rate in the United States, and the United States has the highest teen pregnancy rate in the developed world. Lubbock is number one. So it's not surprising that many there are living out of some pretty sad stories that are creating human sacrifices every day in children born to children who can't and won't care for them, which means that they're also denying the birth of the children who might have been born to them had they grown up, finished developing, and married someone who was able to raise a family. One young man told me that it didn't bother him at all that some local 15-year-old girls were having their second child, or that Lubbock led the nation in births to teenage girls who can't care for their babies, because if even one of those babies comes to know the Lord, it will have been worth it. I don't know what kind of a Lord would sacrifice thousands of human beings for one who believed in a deadly story. In some ways, the business of inadequate stories is a problem for all organized religions which have been in denial and have been flummoxed since the loss of the supernatural realm. When God as God did a couple hundred years ago, when God becomes a concept rather than a critter, the concept often has trouble competing with other concepts and other stories, which many feel lead to more authentic lives. But it isn't just organized religions that have trouble coming up with adequate stories. I read, and I'm sure some of you did too, yesterday in the new issue of Newsweek, about a famous 52-year-old French chef who committed suicide because his restaurant lost its 3-star rating. What's that story about? And the suicide rate of America's teenagers is the highest in the developed world. These are people without stories adequate to sustain a life. In some ways, the most important human question we have is, how do I put the pieces of my life and my world together into an authentic whole? How do I find a story worth my life? Now consider this. What if we already carry within us a kind of invisible force or presence that can help lead us toward the kind of story we need? What if the style of our integrity comes into the world with us, and becoming authentic means learning to communicate with it and live out in its terms our lives? What if you knew you had a guardian angel that was always with you, that knew your soul, that knew your heart, that could help guide you toward wholeness and authenticity? What if it had a kind of invisible presence and power, this guardian angel, that could help you, that could hold you on course and help you be true to yourself if you just learned how to stay in touch with it? What if that were true? That picture is what billions of people for thousands of years have believed is the true order of the universe. It isn't quite the world of the gods. It's more ancient than the gods. It's the world of the invisible powers within our lives, both individually and collectively. It sounds spooky, but I don't think it's supernatural. It's just deeply, powerfully natural, which is fairly super. Since ancient times, most people have believed that this is the way the world is put together and the way we're put together, and I think they're probably right. The Greeks spoke of the daimon that comes into the world with each person and can guide us toward the kind of life we have to lead. The Romans called this our genius, and it doesn't have anything to do with IQ. It comes from the word genie. Our genie, our genius, was a kind of invisible spirit that's a part of us. Some of the great geniuses of history are people who followed the lead of their most amazing genies. I've known a few genuine geniuses in graduate school, and I found them all to be very driven people. They were people who felt that they did not have a choice. They had to do what they were doing. They had to follow the call of their genie. Those I knew did it better than almost anyone alive, so their genies blessed them. But we can all be blessed by our genies, our souls, our callings. Christians have this notion too, though it isn't as intellectual as some of the Roman notions. For centuries, Christians have written about our guardian angel, who acts just about like the daimon or the genius. And both Hindus and Buddhists talk about our karma as that invisible force that seems to contain our script to point toward what we must do this time around. Now, a few years ago, this ancient theory was given another look by the Jungian psychologist James Hillman, who's one of my many favorite authors, in a strange and mixed book called The Soul's Code. That code is the invisible sort of message we carry with us that can point us toward who we need to become and how. Don't think of the soul as a little bag of gas. It's not that sort of thing. It's more like a style. A style of being and living that each one of us brings into the world with us, and no two are exactly alike. And you know this. Now, since this soul is easiest to see in its most dramatic cases, Hillman uses stories of some famous people's lives at the point of their calling to try to make the theory come to life, and I think it works. I want to share just a few of those stories with you. Consider this event. This is true. Happened a long time ago. It's amateur night at the Harlem Opera House. A skinny, awkward 16-year-old goes fearfully on stage. She is announced to the crowd. The next contestant is a young lady named Ella Fitzgerald. Miss Fitzgerald here is going to dance for us. Hold it, hold it. What's your problem, honey? Correction, folks. Miss Fitzgerald has changed her mind. She's not going to dance. She's going to sing. Ella Fitzgerald in that contest sang three encores and won first prize. The rest is history. How did she know it was time to sing? She'd prepared a dance. How did she know it was time to sing? All we know is that she was right. Gold in my ear, another story. Someone called very early. Golda Meir, who led Israel during the 1973 war, was launched by her soul's calling while in fourth grade in the Milwaukee public schools. It can even happen in Milwaukee. She organized a protest group against the required purchase of school books, which were too expensive for the poorer children, who were thus denied equal opportunity to learn. This child of 11 rented a hall to stage a meeting, raised funds, gathered her group of girls, prepped her little sister to declaim a social poem in Yiddish, and then herself addressed the whole assembly without notes. Wasn't she already a Labor Party prime minister? When you see a story this dramatic begin to unfold, it's really mesmerizing. And I just saw one in Lubbock. The highlight of my 4-day trip to Lubbock was meeting a young woman who may very well belong in this kind of company. Astonishing. Her name is Shelby Knox, and she spoke very boldly and very articulately about the need for sex education in public schools. In fact, she presented her speech to the National Education Association 2 years ago, where she was followed by a camera crew from HBO, which has been filming a documentary on her for 2 years and is just now finishing it. Because 2 years ago, when she delivered that speech before the National Education Association, she was 14. My hosts invited her to dinner with some of us, and I had a chance to experience this girl firsthand. She knows exactly who she is and what she has to do. She has no doubts. She has absolutely no doubts that she'll do it. You almost never see that in anyone of any age. She has a 4.0 grade average in high school. She's always had one. After she graduates from high school in 2005, she plans to attend either New York University or American University and begin to learn, she said, how to change the direction of politics, our country, and perhaps the world. I wouldn't bet against her. She reminded me of the theme of this sermon, so I talked with her about this theory of the soul's code that the author of this book also calls his acorn theory, the notion that oaks bear acorns, but acorns are all pregnant with oaks, and we each have an acorn inside of us. And she identified with it immediately. And she said, yes, that's just how it happened. She said, before I knew who I was and what I had to do, I was very confused and I was very scared. And she said, I was just very small and everything was too big and it was just very scary. But after she turned 11, she said everything just became clear. She's discovered an inner beam that shines like a laser beam. That reminded me of the story of the greatest of all Spanish bullfighters, Manolete. As a child, Manolete was timid and fearful. He was delicate and sickly. He was interested only in painting and reading. He clung so tightly to his mother's apron strings that his sisters and his playmates all teased him mercilessly as a sissy. He rarely joined other boys' games of soccer or playing at bullfighting. That all changed suddenly, overnight it seemed, when he was about 11. And for the rest of his life, nothing much mattered except fighting the bulls. Don't let this sound too spooky. We live among a throng of invisibles that order us about, and one of our greatest losses is the ability to communicate with them. What are the invisibles? Family values, self-development, human relationships, personal happiness, and then another more fierce set of mythical figures like control, success, cost-effectiveness, the economy, the American dream. They're invisible. They're the most powerful things in our lives. If we were in old Florence or Rome or Athens, we'd know how to communicate with them. We'd have statues to them. We'd have shrines and grottos and paintings the way they once did of their ancient invisibles like fortune, hope, friendship, grace, modesty, fame, and all the rest of them. But our task here is not to restore all the invisibles, but to discriminate among them by attending to that one that was called your daimon, your soul, your genius, your acorn. In ancient times, the world had been permeated with these invisibles. That's a condition Christianity later called paganism. But throughout history, in almost all cultures, people have had ways of relating to the invisible forces that help guide our lives. That's what prayers are really about too, I think. Not all. At their worst, prayers just sound like selfish petitions for supernatural powers to do us favors. Let our team beat that other heathen team, while the other team's praying the same. It must amuse the gods. And many prayers are just giving thanks for being here at all. But some prayers are our efforts to stay in touch with our own souls. There are poetic efforts to stay in touch with the powerful but invisible dimensions of life that seem to know our name, know our heart, know our soul, know who we need to be, and how we need to become it. That's what I think the African prayer was about that I used this morning. I read through it many times, trying to imagine who it was written to, and that's the only thing that makes sense to me. If I think of it as referring to somebody up above the sky, then I don't know what to do with it. It isn't interesting. But if I think of it as trying to communicate with my own soul, with the angels of my better nature, with a source of wisdom inside of me, closer than my heartbeat, that knows my name and who I need to be, then suddenly the prayer becomes very real and honest in a whole new way. Listen to it again this way. As a way of speaking to whatever it is that you do count on for the wisdom, the direction, and the courage to guide your life, and see if it doesn't speak to you. O Divine One, I give thanks to you, the one who is as near as my heartbeat and more anticipated than my next breath. Let your wisdom become one with this vessel as I lift my voice in thanks for your love. As I lift my voice in thanks for your love.
Amen.